nice to be among friends. I read on the internet that you should always start with a joke. So St. Augustine walks into this bar and he says, "I'll have a martinis." And the bartender looks at him and he says, "Don't you mean a martini?" And Augustine says, "Look, if I wanted a double, I would have ordered one." It's a Roman joke, right? It's a Latin joke. We're going to start out not talking about Constantine directly. We're going to back up a little bit and talk about the crisis of the third century for Rome. Rome was having a bad century, and sort of just like the Chicago Cubs, right? Anybody can have a bad century. And they were certainly having one. They had reached their maximum extent of territory in the second century, 100 years earlier, which was, you know, if you take the Mediterranean Sea and take a wide paintbrush and paint all around the boundaries, that's pretty much what it was. And it included France. Assume I'm a map of Europe, okay? The Rhine River, this is the Rhine, and this is the Danube, and that's where their boundaries were on the two rivers. The Rhine going up on the west side of what is now Germany, and then the Danube, they both start here down by my elbow, just north of the Alps, and the Danube flows off to the Black Sea, which is my other elbow here. And that was the boundaries. And Germany and the stuff that lay to the north and east of that was the barbarians. They had about, at that point, they had about 2.5 million square miles of land territory. For comparison, the continental U.S. is 3. If you include the Mediterranean Sea in that, which is in some sense fair because they had to patrol the whole thing and take care of all the islands and whatnot, that had added another 1 million square miles. So they really controlled an area that was bigger than the continental U.S. at that point. However, now all these frontiers were under pressure from would-be invaders. The Persians in the east were probably the biggest threat to them. The newly formed Sassanian dynasty was pushing on what we now call Syria. Huge threat there. They had problems with the Persians on and off for a long time. Newly conformed confederations of Germanic people were pushing both on the Danube and the Rhine frontiers. They were also attacking northern Italy. They also had some troubles in northern Africa with some tribal issues there from the Berbers. Those were not as serious as the rest, but you know, they had made this big expansion and now they're trying to maintain this and they're having trouble. There was also a lot of political upheavals in the third century. And to understand those, we have to get a bit of background. For its first 250 years or so, Rome was established in about 750 BC, and for the first 250 years they were ruled by kings. The last king was overthrown and a republic was established in about 500 BC. That's not to say democracy, because it wasn't quite that, but it was a republic, which means it wasn't a monarchy anymore. They had a senate, they had two councils who were elected annually, again, not by the general population, by some small and privileged subset of the general population. The republic lasted well into for about 400 years or so, and then there was because of some social unrest and generals like Julius Caesar jockeying for power, the Republic kind of fell apart in the first century BC. Finally, Octavian, who was Julius Caesar's adopted son, came to power in 27 BC, and he declared himself the princeps, the first citizen, and took the name Augustus Caesar. That rule was called the Principate, and in reality, it was a thinly veiled military dictatorship, but Augustus was very careful to never say anything like that, because the Romans still loved this idea of republic, and they would have been very upset to think that they had an emperor at that point, which they did, in fact, but everybody had to sort of not acknowledge that. The problem in all this is that there was no law set down for any succession in this principate. Okay, how are you going to do the succession? There was laws for succession of councils and in the Senate, but now Augustus was just making this up. What happens? Well, they just sort of slop their way through it. Lots of different things happen. Sometimes the Senate would pick the next first citizen. Sometimes it would be a son. Sometimes the military would pick him, but there was no set procedure for how that was going to happen. And that aggravated these problems in the third century. Okay. There was many military men from the Balkans who became emperors, and in fact they call those the barracks emperors, and in the third century. And there were so many of them between 235 and 284, which is just about 50 years. There was 26 legitimate emperors, 3 legitimate subordinates, 41 usurpers, and 5 civil wars. So they really had their, besides all of this problem of being pressured on all their borders, they held all this internal conflict. Only 2 of the emperors, by the way, in that time died natural deaths. Either they were assassinated or they died in battle or something like that. They also had an economic crisis going on in the third century. this empire was turning out to be a very expensive place to run. Who's heard the term bread and circuses? Okay. That's a Roman thing. Okay. Starting, I think, about 150 BC or so, they started to give, the Roman government gave everybody in the city of Rome a ration of grain every day. About at sometime in the first century AD, that was changed to bread. Okay, there was, I saw once they did a census of all the bakeries that was left as a record in history for us. 284 bakeries in Rome. And what they did was bake bread for everybody, and they just handed it out for free. And the circuses, of course, were all the entertainment, which was provided, chariot races and whatnot. But that was expensive. Financing all these wars was tremendously expensive. Keeping all these standing armies all along all these frontiers was really straining the resources of the empire. One result of that was in inflation. In 200 AD, what they call a Roman bushel, which is somewhat smaller than our bushel, a Roman bushel of wheat cost a half a denarius. In 300 AD, it costs 300 denarii. Okay? From half a denarius to 300 denarii. Now that's 100 years. And for those of you who can't find the 100th root of 600 in your head, that's 6.5% a year compounded, but compounded over 100 years. So obviously in some years it wasn't that bad, and in some years it was much worse. One of the things that exacerbated this was that they started to debase the coinage, which denarius was silver. They started to use less and less silver and put silver covering over copper. Where have we seen this before? That was becoming a serious economic problem. All this upheaval is confirmed by the fact that the Romans, who are great builders, right? I mean, the Romans were engineers. In the third century, there's almost no new buildings built anywhere in the empire, which is, I mean, that's a long stretch without anything being built. So that's setting up a little bit of what's going to happen with Constantine. Before we go on with that, I'm going to back up and take a look at relations between Christians and the Roman Empire before Constantine. Christianity was technically illegal. It wasn't illegal because they wrote a law that said Christianity is illegal. It was illegal because in their standing laws, which were written before Christianity was around, you weren't allowed to have new unapproved gods. Okay, if you wanted to bring a god into the into the mix, you had to get official approval for that from Rome. So Christianity had people say, well, it became illegal under Nero. It was always technically illegal because it was very new. The Romans venerated things that were old. The older, the better. And Christianity, this brand new God, was something that didn't appeal to them at all. That, plus the persecution of Nero in 64 AD, that was the first persecution of Christians, sort of pushed Christianity underground. Interestingly enough, Romans are really considered to be inclusive by historians and to grant a lot of religious freedom. Roman persecution of Christians did not have the same basis as, say, Hitler's persecution of the Jews. It was not based on, well, couldn't have been based on ethnicity because Christians were across all ethnic boundaries, but it wasn't a we hate Christians kind of a thing. Romans were polytheistic pagans, and they believed that part of the reason for their success was that their gods were on their side, okay? And what you had to do for the gods is you had to give them their due. You had to do the sacrifices. You had to do all the mumbo jumbo, whatever it is, because they had dozens of gods. But as long as you gave the gods their due, you'd appease them, and then they were on your side, and then you would have success. So it was considered a civic duty for all citizens to sacrifice to the Roman gods and to pray for Roman society. This is the reason that they came into conflict with Christians, because many Christians refused to do that. Now, enforcement depended very, very heavily on local officials. I'm going to do a little side street here on the way Rome ran their empire. Especially for the first two-thirds of the Roman Empire, they did not install a lot of their own people in places that they took over. The genius of the whole Roman system was that they would co-opt the leaders that were in their places, like King Herod, okay? Great example of that. They would co-opt some of the leaders, and a lot of times they would make the leading citizens Roman citizens, okay? They say, we're going to give you guys citizenship, you, this elite group, the existing leaders, but we want you to keep your people in line. They also had varying degrees of citizenship for the people that they would take over. And there was about four or five different tiers. So there was always, they would always hold out the carrots. Or, you know, if you're good boys and girls, y'all can move up to the next tier, okay? This was a tremendous break from what was normal in the ancient world. What was normal in the ancient world is if you got took over, all the adult males in your city would be killed. The women and children would be either taken as slaves or then sold into slavery. And your city would be trashed. And it would be end of story. Probably the whole reason that Rome became as big as it was is because they were much more pragmatic than that. They didn't do that with people. They tried not to beat up on them. It sounds strange sometimes, but they would actually rather have them cooperate. That's how they got to be as big as they got to be. So that, after that digression, local officials tended to be in charge. What Rome said, was fine, but what really went in the local areas was dependent on your local officials. And so if your local officials didn't really care that much about Christianity, you were probably golden. It was easier to fly up under the radar outside the big cities, maybe have a slave come in and do your sacrifice for you, okay? There was all kinds of ways to try to get around that. Rome really wanted from its citizens basic loyalty. They didn't want you to cause trouble. If you caused trouble, they would come in and pound you into the dust and make an example of you. But otherwise, there was carrots in terms of protection, in terms of services and things like that. Because Judaism was very old, Rome, it was actually legal. It was called out in their legal system as being a legal religion because it was so old. Now, the Romans didn't get it. They didn't get this idea of a transcendent God. But they said, yeah, but you guys are old. You know, you've been around for a long, long time, so you're good. And the Jews would actually go in and pray for the leaders of Rome, mostly. They found ways to sort of get around the issues. So during good times, persecution of Christians were very local and very sporadic. During bad times, that's when the trouble would usually start. And the third century was a bad time, right? There was more persecution as the empire believed that the gods were punishing them because the citizens weren't doing their stuff. They weren't going and performing their sacrifices. Empire-wide persecutions began for the first time in the third century. First, it was under the Emperor Decius in 250, and next under Valerian in 258. The persecutions under Nero were not empire-wide. They were just in Rome. Okay, starting in 284, the Emperor Diocletian instituted a variety of very clever, sort of outside-the-box reforms that got the empire back on its feet. He's, in some sense, the immediate predecessor to Constantine. So what did Diocletian do? He divided the empire up into east-west halves. The dividing line was ran just to the west of the Balkan Peninsula. Okay, so Italy and all that stuff were in the western part, and Greece and Asia Minor, Turkey and Syria were all in the eastern part. And then what he did is he put an empire in each half, an Augustus, he called him, in each half. And he was one of the Augustus. He was Augustus in the east. He set up a guy called Maximian as Augustus in the west. And then he said, each of us Augustuses is going to have a Caesar underneath him. He's picking names out of the Roman past. They're going to have a Caesar underneath him, and that was called the Tetrarchy, the rule of four. The idea was that when the Augustuses died, the Caesars, you would not have this problem of who's going to succeed them. The Caesars would come up to be Augustus, and then they would pick their own Caesars. He also spread them out along the boundaries of the empire. Instead of having them in Rome, he put one at Trier, which is up, think Paris, okay, it's close, up near the Rhine, one at Milan, one at Nicomedia, which is close to modern-day Istanbul, close to where Constantinople was going to be, and then the other one, different sources say different places, but Antioch was where the other one usually hung out a lot, which is really close to the Persians. So, in one fell swoop, he sort of set up a better guard along the borders. These guys could also act as a cap on any generals who might get ideas. That was one of the problems they had with generals who would get ideas about becoming emperor. They were right there, out there in the field to try to keep a lid on that. And that really worked quite well for a while anyway. Diocletian also grouped up, he took Roman provinces, he increased the number a little bit to 100, there had been about 70, I think, and he divided them into 12 dioceses. Each diocese was ruled by a vicar. Now, who took over that naming system, okay? That was not a naming system original with the church. That was with Diocletian's system. Each of the 12 dioceses were divided into four prefectures, okay? And that was one for each person in the Tetrarchy. Civil and military leaders were sharply differentiated. That hadn't been the case before. Rome became sort of a command economy. Before, it was based more on supply and demand. But another thing that Diocletian did was he greatly increased the number of civil servants. Because of the way they did things, getting local rulers to try to run things. They ran on a very few number of civil servants. Sources differ. Some people say maybe 500 for the whole empire. Some people say, no, it had to be closer to 3,000, but by the time Diocletian got done, there were 35,000 civil servants running the empire. The veneer of the principate was finally dropped, and the emperors now were referred to as dominus, lord and master. And their rule was called the dominate. Okay. So they were firmly in charge. Diocletian was totally committed to the traditional gods of Rome. He forged an ideology in which the emperors were the favorites of the gods. He also launched a program of restoring pagan shrines and sanctuaries that had fallen into disrepair in the 3rd century. Diocletian launched a campaign of extensive persecutions on Christians. These were the worst the empire had ever seen. In part because of the things I just said, he was totally committed to these gods. There was also a thing they called a failed sacrifice. What does that mean? When they would sacrifice animals to their gods, they would have the priest go read the entrails, sort of like reading tea leaves, but he would read the entrails. And there was one of these sacrifices done, and the entrails looked bad. And the priest said, you've got too many Christians in the army. And that was one of the things that spurred Diocletian on to get these persecutions underway. Definitely the worst and the longest Christians had ever endured. They lasted for about 10 years, starting in 303. Then Diocletian did something unprecedented. In 305, he retired. That never happened before. He arm-twisted the Western Augustus, Maximian, into retiring as well. Then the idea was that the Caesars would step up into those positions and pick their own Caesars. Well, that succession didn't go very well. And the turmoil, which we could spend some time talking about, but lasted for about 8 years. Ultimately, it ended up with one of the Caesars had been Constantius, who was the father of Constantine. He died during this turmoil of 8 years, and Constantine came up to take his place. Eventually, Constantine ended up facing off with Maxentius, who was a self-proclaimed emperor and a usurper. This showdown happened near Rome at a bridge over the Tiber River called the Milvian Bridge. This happened in 312. Constantine was outnumbered by a considerable margin, some sources say as many as 2-1. The events that happened there are recorded by two different Roman writers who both knew Constantine, Lactantius and the better known Eusebius of Caesarea, who was a bishop in the town of Caesarea, and also an early historian. They gave, of course, different versions of events, somewhat different versions. In fact, Eusebius himself wrote about it twice, once in his Ecclesiastical History and once in his Life of Constantine, and even those two are different versions. They don't at least conflict. So we'll use the Eusebius version. The day before the battle, Constantine and his troops saw a vision in the sky, okay? The Christogram, the Chiro. Now, Lactantius version, this is a cross. But Eusebius said it was the Chiro, which would, Chi as an X and a Rho is like a P. It would be a P going right up the center of it, and that was called the Christogram for the first two letters of Christ in the Greek alphabet, Chiro. along with the motto, in hoc signo victor eris, which means, in this sign you will conquer. Eusebius adds that night Constantine had a dream in which Christ appeared to him and explained that he should go into the battle under the sign of the Chiro. So he did that. He had it, you know, again, there's differing accounts, but he had it put on some of his banners at least, and maybe on shields. He did so, and he won this really quick victory over Maxentius, even though he was well outnumbered. It wasn't as much the vision or the dream as it was winning from a weaker position under the Christian sign that captivated both Constantine and the people. He was showing that the Christian God really came through for you. You know, if you did the right stuff and pulled the right levers and stuff, the Christian God was going to come through for you. And that was a big deal for the Romans. Okay. So Constantine becomes emperor. And one of his first acts was the Edict of Milan in 313. Notice, by the way, this is Milan now. Rome is pretty much out of the picture permanently in terms of the Roman Empire. When they moved the capitals out, that sort of marked the beginning of the end as things started to decay. But Rome was going to, Rome was, went from a city of 1 million to a city of maybe 50,000, if that. Okay, so Rome was going to be out of the picture now. Anyway, the Edict of Milan in 313 essentially proclaimed freedom of religion. It didn't make Christianity the official religion of Rome. It didn't outlaw paganism, but it certainly made Christianity legal. Also, during the persecutions of Diocletian, they had confiscated church property and things like that. The Edict of Milan returned that. In 314, he called the Council of Arles, which was to sort out the Donatist controversy. That happened in North Africa. Very briefly, during the persecutions of Diocletian, some Christians gave in. They did what sometimes all they asked of them was to hand in their scriptures. Sometimes they had to sacrifice, but whatever it was, some of the Christians gave in. And there was a sect in North Africa that said, if you gave in, you have to be rebaptized. You can't just confess, you have to be rebaptized. And they also said, if you're a priest or a bishop, now you're done being a priest or a bishop, because everything you do now is unauthorized as a priest or a bishop after if you caved in to the persecution. Anyway, they had to sort that out, and Constantine himself made that decision, and he said, no, they don't have to be rebaptized. See, actually, this is probably the right decision. Confession is enough. In his conversion to Christianity, Constantine followed the advice of Augustus Caesar to make haste slowly. He moved carefully and deliberately, trying not to upset the many pagans that were still around him. Later in his life, he began to unambiguously declare himself a Christian, and at that time he made it clear to other Christians in his writing that he believed his success was due to the protection of the Christian God alone. But again, note that theme, I'm successful because of what God is doing for me. I'm a little bit of sort of a superstitious attitude running in through there. It was very common. Some coins and inscriptions in the empire began to show the Cairo symbol. Not a lot of them, but some of them. Some of them continued to show the sun god and other Roman deities, but Constantine had those eventually. It took time. He had those all replaced by pictures of the emperor's family and other non-religious symbols. He didn't go whole hog in putting Christian symbols on coins, but he got the pagan symbols off. In 325, of course, he called the Council of Nicaea, which many of you know about, very famous, to sort out the Arian controversy, and that was a controversy over the status of the Trinity. Arius claimed that Christ was a created being, important, first created being and all that, but still not co-equal, co-eternal with the Father. Different sources give different perspectives on Constantine's participation. Some say he ruled over it, some say he wasn't there. It seems most likely he attended as an observer, but he did give his stamp of approval to the outcome at the end, which was the concept of the Trinity as we know it. And, of course, the Nicene Creed. Sort of a huge change was evidenced at the Council of Nicaea. Some of the bishops that were there, and there were many, many in attendance, several hundred. Some of those bishops had been persecuted by Diocletian and bore the scars of the torture that they received during the persecution. And here they are now being invited by the emperor to come and make this very important decision. Constantine moved the capital, the imperial capital, from Rome to the newly planned city of Constantinople, which was formerly Byzantium. And that's where you get in later part of the Roman Empire, when the West goes away and you've just got the East, they call it the Byzantine Empire, that's why. Constantinople, though, was a brand new city, put on in a brand new place, very easy to defend, surrounded on three sides by water. But it was planned as a Christian city. No pagan temples, at least, to start out with. He also began a program of church building, modeled after a type of Roman public building called a basilica. And that's why you see a lot of the churches in Asia Minor are called this basilica or that basilica. Constantine declared Christians, bishops, an ordo, which was a legal class with specific rights and privileges. He invested a lot of powers in the bishops, so they increasingly displaced the pagan decurion leaders in the provincial cities. They had the patronage of the emperor. They could hand out jobs, paying jobs to people. Constantine also supported missionary activity outside the Roman world. This started first in the Caucasus Mountains between the Black and Caspian Seas. Perhaps the most well-known actually took place under his son, Constantius II, who sent a former barbarian named Ulfilas to the Goths north of the Danube, and many of those were converted, albeit to Arian Christianity. The Nicene Creed and the Council of Nicaea did not put an end to the Arian controversy by any means. That carried on for another 100 years at least. Okay, let's address some questions about Constantine's conversion. Was his conversion just the final act of a rising, powerful Christian movement? Some authors, most notably Eusebius, present Constantine as the almost inevitable triumph of Christianity that was becoming powerful through the 3rd century, fertilized, if you will, by the blood of martyrs. This view was popular even with historians until recent times, when research has concluded that there were far fewer Christians in the world in 312 than had been previously believed, a very small minority of the population. They didn't hold any important positions in the imperial government, and this sort of casts doubt on that interpretation. Eusebius says that Christians were a large minority. So how can we compute that? Was he over-exuberant or lying to us? I think, and this is my own guess as to what may have happened from all the stuff I've read, they may have been a large minority in cities. If you think, where did Paul go and preach? In the big cities, Antioch, Ephesus, Corinth. And that's where Christianity really took a hold and got a lot of converts. Out in the country, not so much. At that point in time, 85% of the population or more lived in the country. So it could have been a large minority in cities, but still with a relatively unconverted countryside, it could have been, in terms of the whole population, it might have been a very small minority. This view that Constantine's conversion was this inevitable triumph also raised more problems than it solves. If it's true, why didn't he just go ahead and make Christianity the official religion? Why did he move so slowly and cautiously? Why did his nephew Julian, who was popular, attempt to turn the empire back around just 24 years after his death? They called him Julian the Apostate. He was emperor 24 years after Constantine died. He sort of tried to turn everything back to paganism. And he was a popular emperor, not necessarily for that reason. But it just makes much more sense that this was a real and surprise turning point, and that Constantine was doing something very new and very unexpected. What about Constantine's Christianity? Was he a genuine Christian? And if so, when did he convert? Of course, none of us are in a position to judge whether he was a genuine Christian or not, church visible, church invisible, right? But this has been endlessly debated by historians, and it depends on where you put in the burden of proof. Christian writers who were his contemporary have a tendency to gush over Constantine. And Eusebius, I mean, if you read him, he just goes on and on and on. But you can excuse him for that. I mean, Eusebius was born in 260. He He probably heard about the persecutions under Decius and Domitian. He lived through the persecutions under Diocletian. And now he sees suddenly Constantine convert and Christianity suddenly explodes in the empire. And he was a happy guy. Some believe that he was brought up as a Christian by his mother Helena, who was later canonized as a saint and journeyed to Jerusalem claiming to find the true cross. Others claim it was late, if at all, that Constantine became a Christian, and they point out such things as his waiting until he was on his deathbed to be baptized. But that, you know, in those days, baptism was seen as a complete washing away of sins, and the later the better, because otherwise you might get some more sin on you after you're baptized. So that's not such a big deal, especially back in those days. It's also very difficult to conceive of Constantine following up with the actions the way he did over his career if he wasn't sincere. Church councils, the Christian city of Constantinople, supporting bishops through patronage, supporting missions, etc. I think that it makes a lot of sense that his conversion was sincere and that he became a Christian over a period of years following his conquest of the Golden Bridge. Okay, so what are sort of the reverberations of this conversion of Constantine? He ruled until his death in 337, and his sons, who were also Christians, then took over the rule, and they ruled until 361. This set the tone, and all subsequent Roman emperors, except for Julian the Apostate, who only ruled for 2 years, were Christians. The apparent power of the Christian God to do good things for the empire may have had a lasting effect here. The empire was perhaps, and again, these numbers are really hard for historians to guess at, but they think maybe in the time of Augustine, 100 years after Constantine, the empire was maybe 50% Christian. And by the time of Justinian, 550, it was maybe 90% Christian. It was just about completely Christian at the time of Justinian. Pagan decurions had always given out distributions to citizens at pagan festivals. That was what they did. But the higher you rank, the more you receive. So if you're a really rich person and you would go to the local pagan festivals, you'd get a big gift. And if you were really poor, you'd get next to nothing. The bishops in the cities absolutely reversed that procedure, and they started they used that as a time for almsgiving and for supporting and distributing things to the poor. So immediately things started to get better for the poor in the cities. When Christianity was illegal in the empire, the accepted way to demonstrate your Christian commitment was to boldly, publicly, and steadfastly identify yourself as a Christian who would not sacrifice to the Roman gods and take the consequences. Partly because this is no longer available to people, monasticism flowered in the 4th century. In fact, it exploded as a way of devotion. The first monastic community was in 323 in Upper Egypt and was modeled after Saint Antony in Egypt. Saint Antony is considered to be the first monk. He started the ascetic life in about 280. The people there used to call him the Monachos, which means the lonely one in the local language. So from Monachos came the word monk. Also with monasticism gave women a way they could put their faith into action. Again, women in the Roman Empire had very little opportunity to do anything, but monasticism gave them a way to do something. There was also a lot of Christians around then who say that monasticism is really required of you by scripture. So monasticism really took off. By the year 500, there were 60 to 70 known monasteries in Constantinople and 40 to 50 more in surrounding towns. After Constantine, the identity that determined your position in the Roman world began changing from, are you a Roman citizen, to, are you a Christian? Kenneth Harrell, who was one of the big, more prominent people, scholars in the country today on late antiquity, said that this is probably the most momentous event in all of Western history, the conversion of Constantine and subsequent turn in the Roman Empire to Christianity. A 19th century scholar, another big guy in late antiquity, whose name was J.B. Bury, wrote this: "The conversion of Constantine is probably one of the most audacious acts carried out by an autocrat in violation of the religious opinions of the majority of his subjects. While St. Paul gave Christianity the potential to be a world faith, Constantine, by his conversion and the institutions he forged, would make Christianity the religion of not only the Roman world, but ultimately of Europe." And as we progress from late antiquity into the Middle Ages, we're going to have well over 1,000 years where virtually anybody you ask in Europe, if they're not a Jew, and they're not a Muslim, which is really rare in Europe, a few in Spain, if you ask anybody if they're a Christian, they're going to say yes. It's virtually 100%, well into the late Middle Ages. So the last question was this a good thing? To the Christians of that era, no regrets, okay? This was completely positive. In fact, it was wonderful, and it's not hard to see their point of view. However, we got off to a bad start here with in hoc signo victor eris, okay, with in this sign you will conquer. In my own mind, I don't believe for a second that Christ told him that, okay? It's completely contrary to everything Christ said in the New Testament. And also, Christianity was popularized for a bad reason, that the Christian God really paid off when you paid him homage. If you pull the right levers and hit the right buttons, you're going to be successful. Another question is, do you really want the church so tightly bound up with the state? That's going to continue for another 1,400 years. Now, if you had asked them that question back then, they would have looked at you like you were, they wouldn't have understood the question. Of course, religion is tied up with the state. It's always been tied up with government. They had no concept of some kind of separation between the two. Obviously, it's a good thing that legal Christianity made public preaching possible and the spread of the gospel without persecution. It's also hard to find fault with much of what Constantine did, making freedom of religion the law of the empire, helping to stabilize Christianity with the councils of Arles and especially Nicaea, and supporting missionary activity. However, this change is going to take darker turns as it progresses. First, with all other religions being made illegal, and then with persecutions against non-Christians, and then eventually with forced conversions. Is this a culture that we really want, where Christianity is the only legal religion and it's forced on you? Obviously, we don't see that in the New Testament. Would it be better to be a persecuted minority? Do the ends justify the means? I'll leave those questions and turn it over to you for questions, if you have any. Jan, Rick?
So the vision gave, that's what happens, maybe it happens, which, as you mentioned, that would be contrary to how we tend to think of Christ, although not all Christians would have a problem with that, he thought it happened, but he was deceived. He was deceived in some way, or it's sort of legend, or it didn't really happen, but it's been made up that it happened. Maybe there's other choices, but the general sense that Constantine thought it happened? He was sure it happened.
Absolutely.
But he's not, so it,
Yeah, Eusebius got his account firsthand from Constantine. Yeah, so he thought it happened. And you know, you read all kinds of things like, well, the sun, when you know, at certain times of the day or with certain cloudy patterns, you can, going into the human eyes, could look like a Cairo. I mean, I don't know. Who knows what happened, right? It's a good question. It'd be great to be a soldier. Because he says, Constantine says, the soldiers out there saw it too. Be nice to be one of those soldiers and see it for yourself. Yeah?
Randy, when was Attila the Hun?
Later. He was, Attila was about, he was in late antiquity, about the time of Justinian, about 6th century. Yeah.
And he was east, wasn't he?
Yeah, and then he came riding into the west, and a lot of the barbarians, and that maybe if we do enough of these, I'll get to the he pushed a lot of the quote-unquote barbarians out into Roman territory. Let me take a look. That's one of the reasons I brought this book. It's got a lot of good dates in it. Let's see if he's got Attila in here. I don't see it. I'll confirm that for you. It's definitely much, much later than Constantine. 6th century, I think, yeah. Right.
Randy, one thing that came to my mind, you said that the day that the emperor, the Caesars, didn't call themselves a king or an emperor, and that they were, but we also get the impression that they projected themselves as deities.
And
we have, we have no emperor, no king but Caesar. Here's your king of the Jews. No, we have no king but Caesar.
Yeah.
Of course, that's not in Rome, and it doesn't have that. They're used to a king, and maybe Rome isn't, so they use different terminology, but you understand some of that about the deification.
Right. Theoretically, that was supposed to happen after you died, okay? 2 years after Julius Caesar was assassinated, the Roman Senate proclaimed him a deity. And they said, well, now he's ascended up to Mount Olympus or wherever it was that their deities came from, and he's now with the gods. And so that became, that interestingly, that made Augustus what? The son of God. Okay. That the idea was that they would, you know, after they died, they would go to be with and become deified. And you're right, I mean, they got to be sort of worshipped even in their time. And one of the reasons Augustus got to be so popular is because Rome was really in pretty ragged shape in the first century BC. They had this civil unrest and all of this jockeying for power of the generals was called the Roman Revolution. And it lasted for quite a long time. And it really didn't get resolved until Augustus Caesar, until he took control as the first citizen and sort of restored order. And so he was greatly revered.
We're familiar with some of that Antony and Cleopatra.
Yes, right, yeah. Kevin.
Constantine's piety,
not much. Yeah, not much, because he was really separated, right, from people, and there wasn't much observation of him. And you know, there's some writings of his to other Christians that would indicate that, you know, he really thought that his success came from God. And I mean, in some ways, that could be a laudable sentiment, right? But we don't really know all that much about his piety. There was some incidents just before he died. He kind of did a little mini purge before he died and had some people killed. And the those who would say he was never a Christian like to cite that. They say, well, he had some people killed. Well, so did King David. You know, I mean, you know, and David wasn't, that was, yeah, yeah. So, he certainly wasn't without sin. But I mean, I think the only fair way to judge a man is to take it at face value. But there isn't a lot of information about that, you know, about his piety in his personal life.
You mentioned how small Rome was and maybe deteriorating city. Why do you think, without that space, that the bishopric in Rome rose to be higher than the others?
Yeah.
Because we're talking about Nicaea, you know, some of those times, which is sounds like it's well after Rome was an important city.
Yeah. That's a very interesting question. How did the Bishop of Rome get to be Pope, right? Evidence that they've gathered from the first few centuries, from the first 2 centuries AD, indicates that a lot of times when they had some difficult problem, some of the other bishops would write to Rome and ask for advice. Okay. Well, why did they do that? There seems to be the idea that there was this idea of apostolic succession. Peter and Paul had both died in Rome, and that they were that the Bishop of Rome was therefore the successor to them. This idea of apostolic succession was really important in the early church, that they believed that idea, that those letters going to Rome asking for advice, are evidence of the fact that people believed in this apostolic succession idea. That's number one. Second is that coming down the road after Constantine is Theodosius, who made paganism illegal. And he also wrote, in one of his laws was that if you want to know what orthodoxy is, besides the Nicene Creed, you ask the Bishop of Rome. So he got a big legal boost at that time, too. Those are two of the reasons that the Pope got to be the Pope. But, you know, I think the one of apostolic succession seems to have some merit behind it. They seem to be going to Rome early on for leadership. Anything else? Thank you very much.